gentlemen, fellow libertarians, fellow citizens of the world, diners, drinkers, boozers, fakers and shakers, you're all welcome. It's another meeting of the Libertarian Alliance. Our guest speaker this week is David McDonough. His topic is going to be
Keynesian Revolution.
The Keynesian Revolution, pretty topical, sadly always topical. He will talk for as long as it takes, go on a little bit, and then be questioned after a period of recharging the glasses. David, please begin.
Right, thank you very much indeed, Bob. My problem that I set out to try to explain in this talk was why did the Keynesian Revolution happen when it seems to be so full of paradoxes, if not absurdities? There is a book published by William Van Arnam Quine in 1966 called The Ways of Paradox, and in this Quine points out there's two types of paradox. It might not be immediately obvious which type of paradox you're dealing with to begin with when you first see the paradox. It either contradicts common sense but it's correct, and so sooner or later common sense will catch up with it and it will cease to be paradoxical, or it is an intrinsic paradox, in which case it will always look paradoxical and it may well even be absurd. The example that Quine gives of the first sort of paradox is the man who is an adult, but he's only had about four or five birthdays. When you find out that he was born on February the 29th, paradox is removed, because owing to leap year, we only have February 29th, every 5 years or so. And then an example of the second type of paradox that Quine gives is the village where everyone who isn't shaved by the barber is shaved by themselves. If you think about that, there can be no such village, because I'm sorry that I violated you to this extent.
We just don't want to interrupt you. We're visiting from town. So sorry.
So there can be no such village where the everyone who isn't shaved by the barber shaves themselves. Because who shaved the barber? Is it himself? It's a paradox, it's a contradiction, it's an absurdity. Now Keynes's book, The General Theory of Employment, Interest and Money, is full of paradoxes. It goes from paradox to paradox. And we may see some of these farces when the wife catches the husband in a farcical position. He says he can explain everything, but if he's generally speaking a well-written farce, he explains in terms of further paradox, and he just gets deeper and deeper into the mire. Obviously, if he can't explain by some command of common sense, so the wife can not see a paradox but see a complete explanation, then of course he's going to go deeper and deeper into trouble. Now with this book, Keynes does seem to go from paradox to paradox, and although he insistently says that observation will back him up and that everyone knows that he's right anyway, nevertheless what he comes up with is paradox after paradox after paradox. Insofar as he's referring to anything when he says observation backs him up and that everyone knows he's right anyway, I think that the common sense will agree with him insofar as he's attacking economics, and economics has never really been popular. It was of course called the Dismal Science by Carlyle, and it's had plenty of propaganda against it, and so in a sense Keynes's main target, which was economics, was an open door.
Now, excuse me, you're going to have to wait to do the maintenance when more customers have eaten. There's no one for them to eat downstairs. No, I'm not saying it kicks them out, but obviously they can't sit and eat while you're having a meeting. So I'll get them back up and then you can carry on sort of while they've eaten.
Sorry about that. I've certainly booked the room, but he says that he was away when it was booked.
Yeah,
Well, I phoned. I phoned up a telephone number that David gave me. David Goldstone gave me. And
there is Max and someone else downstairs. So I don't see how many more customers they can fit in.
Well, 4 or 5 left room.
4 or 5
left. Sorry about this.
Yeah.
I did. I did book the room, but I didn't. Yeah, I've never seen him before. First time I've seen him, I spoke to him over the phone.
Yeah, so I saw.
If we explain that.
But I don't know whether it was him or someone else who I spoke to over the phone.
Maybe.
But he says that it was booked while he was on holiday. So presumably that was with David.
Huh? Yeah, that's right. So don't go away because if you are staying for the talk, what we want is, you know, people who are staying for the talk want to occupy as many seats as possible to crowd out the people who are not coming for the talk, so that so that they get discouraged and leave. You want to sit there?
I'd like to see if I can make up against. I don't think they can.
Oh, well, it's a good idea. No, I don't think they complain. I think what he's saying is that they don't have enough room downstairs.
Well, look, there are only the four.
They're
only those three having food. I'm sure
there
were seats downstairs. Well, they weren't eating, though, were they? They finished their drinks and left.
Yeah, so we'll
it was only those three that had food.
But
well,
they left.
Well,
why
don't
we
carry on?
Why don't
we carry on?
Okay. So basically, we're talking about a mindset here. As I say, there is a mindset against economics, owing to a long tradition. And although Keynes was a trained economist, Keynes took his degree in mathematics, but his father was John Neville Keynes, and wrote books on economics and also on logic and scientific method. And he was a friend of Alfred Marshall, John Neville Keynes. And so we got Maynard to do some postgraduate economics with Marshall. But Marshall was replaced by Arthur Cecil Pigou. Pigou's, oddly enough, seems to be Keynes's main opponent in this book. This book seems to be a criticism. This came out in 1936. Seems to be a criticism of Pigou's theory of unemployment, which came out in 1933. But Keynes, although he trained somewhat as an economist, adopted many of these ideas. Keynes joined, more or less joined the Fabian Society, and he knew George Bernard Shaw and the Webbs and so on, and he was basically a Fabian. And the thing about the Fabian Society is that it was started off in the 1880s, and it was fond of elites, and it contrasted quite a bit with the Social Democratic Federation, insofar as the Social Democratic Federation went along with the materialist interpretation of history, which was Marx's idea, that there was no need to ever have elites, because basically society will work itself up into a situation where ordinary common sense will be able to see that we can go through to the next mode of production. Therefore, there's no the common sense will sort this out without elites. Now, the Fabian Society broke away from them and set up an elitist society, and they also set up the idea of doing things gradually. And many of the Fabians before long were pretty much content with the bourgeois society, except that they liked management. Now, of course, as I've said in some earlier talks, the idea of management came mainly in the Liberal Party in the 1880s from Joseph Chamberlain, who sought it out as mayor of Birmingham before he became became a Liberal MP. He sorted out some slum estates in Birmingham, and he pushed through in the centre of Birmingham a street called Corporation Street after demolishing certain slums there. And you can see this street in the middle of Birmingham now if you go there. Corporation Street runs from New Street Station up to the fire station. It contains some of the old law courts. He had the idea that radical management was needed, and he didn't like economics all that much. Now, he became engaged to a lady called Beatrice Webb. She was Beatrice Potter at that time, but she didn't want to marry him, and she instead married Sidney Webb.
Not that Beatrice Potter.
Not Beatrice with an X, no, who wrote about the rabbits. Beatrice with an E, who didn't write about rabbits. Beatrice remained in love with Joe, and the Fabian Society was like a hymn to Joseph Chamberlain, and the idea was management. And she had in common with Joe didn't like economics very much, he found them boring. Beatrice also says in her diary that she found them boring, but Keynes didn't find economics boring, but in a sense he was more or less antagonistic towards it, even though he's trained as it as an economist. And my contention is that that Keynes had in common with Marx two things. One, they didn't like anarchy, he preferred management, and he saw the market, the self-sustained market, as an anarchy, which he found abhorrent. He thought the elite should be able to do something to aid the market. Second thing that he had in common with Marx is that he didn't really like economics, and he was an anti-economist as well as to some extent a trained economist. He was also an anti-economist, and this book is a work of anti-economics. Now, if you open up this book on the first page, it will have a curious thing. Keynes writes on the very first page that I'm going to propagate the solecism. He says, although I know the classical economists have been called by Marx, he doesn't say Marx, but Marx would actually call them the classical economists. He says, although I know that the classical economists have been called all the economists from Adam Smith up to John Stuart Mill, I am actually going to say that the classical economists include also people up to Marshall, who was his teacher, and Pigleau, who was the person who replaced Marshall as his teacher. And I'm going to call all those the classical economists. Now, you might think it's rather odd for someone to include the solecism, an author, any author at all, to include the solecism on the first page of their book. Generally speaking, a solecism, as you might know, is a mistake of grammar. If I, often in, sadly, in my emails, I have solecisms, and if I see them, I remove them. If I say, it's like using a singular where a plural should do. If they say, they is going to church, you shouldn't say that, you should say, they are going to church. In other words, get rid of his, which would be a solecism here, and replace it with are, are, which would be the plural, which would remove the solecism. Any author who saw a solecism of any sort in his books would remove it. However, you even then have a look, think about what Keynes is saying, and you realise that he's not talking about a solecism at all, he's not talking about grammar at all, he's talking about history. He's saying that, in actual fact, he considers the classical economists to be all the economists right up to himself, and that he's going to talk against these people. Now, this is an anachronism rather than a solecism, but even if we settle on an anachronism, a person who sees an anachronism in their own writing, anachronism is a mistake like a solecism. It's a mistake about history rather than about grammar. A person who sees an error will remove it, as Plato quite rightly pointed out, and very profoundly pointed out, or at least I think profoundly. Most people think it isn't so profound. But Plato pointed out that no human being can possibly err, deliberately err. In other words, you can't deliberately err. I can't deliberately and accidentally spill over this glass. If I do knock the glass and it spills over, that'll be an accident, in which case it really is an accident. But if I intend to knock it over, then it's not an accident. There's no way I can have a deliberate error. An error is, now if I see either a solecism or an anachronism, then I would automatically amend it. Now, what I think that Keynes is really doing here with his so-called solecism, and I think it is, this might seem to you as a, and as it seemed to me when I first started on this track, as a pedantic criticism of the book. But I think it is actually the key to the whole book. It's the key to many of the paradoxes in the book. Because what it is actually is not a solecism or an anachronism, but a ploy. And his ploy is this, that Whatley once said, Richard Whatley, the Archbishop Whatley, once said, the economist and theologian, once said, there's all the difference in the world between whether a man puts the truth in the first or in the second place. And what Keynes is more or less saying here is that I have got a message and I'm going to put the truth in the second place and I'm going to ignore this message. I'm going, when I say things, I'm going to say certain things which come in regard to my message. So what Keynes is more or less saying here is that he is going to have it that all the economists up to him was the classical economists, and he's also going to say things about the classical economists which is equally as false, but he's not going to bother about them being false because he's got a message to write, and he's going to write this message. And the main message he's got to say about the classical economists is that they didn't understand involuntary unemployment. But also there is another message which is that's the main upfront message. He's talking about the problem of mass unemployment. But he's also got something else to say. He doesn't like the theory of equilibrium in economics. He doesn't like that at all. He prefers to go back to Malthus, where it was difficult to get an equilibrium, and jobs were numbered, and wages could fall to below starvation level. He likes that sort of thing. He thinks that wages can fall below starvation level. And so he's got a message. Now, he's often going to say that the classical economists say this, that and the other, but it is just his solecism. It isn't necessarily what the classical economists say. Now, as I say, he mentions earlier on in the first few pages the book that I say he's mainly criticising, namely Piglow's theory of employment, theory of unemployment, beg your pardon. And this is the main book he's criticising. Now, in this book, Piglow says repeatedly that there are some, that there's plenty of involuntary unemployment. But Keynes says again and again and again that the classical economists can't even imagine that there is any such thing as mass unemployment, involuntary unemployment. They only say two things. He says, Keynes says there are three types of unemployment. There's fictional unemployment, which is basically the sort of unemployment that we have between jobs. If I leave a job on a Monday and I go to another job for another firm on a Friday, if I leave a job on a Friday, I go to another job with another firm on a Monday, I'll have been fictionally unemployed over the weekend. So that's one type. Secondly is voluntary unemployment, which he defines in a rather strange way, which I'll come to in a minute. And that is where we could get a job, but we don't want to get a job because the conditions don't suit us, although he has ordinarily that's what it is. And then he says, he defines it in a way, as I'll cover in a few moments, that I think covers what most people would consider anyway to be involuntary unemployment. But still, we'll come to that in a few moments. And then he says there is that which the classics don't comprehend actually exists, and that is involuntary unemployment. They overlook this completely and utterly. Now, his basic strategy is that you have these three types of unemployment, then you have a situation where the classics know only about one and two. They only know fictional unemployment and voluntary unemployement. But he says the real problem of unemployment is this unemployment that they overlook, involuntary unemployment. This involuntary unemployment, this number three that they overlook, is owing to the lack of demand, and this is his major thesis. So therefore then he concludes that any amount of price flexibility will not get rid of this involuntary unemployment, because it is owing to a lack of demand. Now a lack of effective demand. Now he does say that and this is where Keynes very often has many contradictions in the book, And one of the major contradictions in the book is this, that he says both that there is a need for a fall in real wages in order to cure mass unemployment, and he says that there is also mass unemployment will never cure a drop in real wages will never cure mass unemployment. So he says both that and sometimes he actually brings this forward to a contradiction, saying that it's futile getting real wages down. It won't cure mass unemployment. But what it really means, we can reconcile these the contradiction and even the conflict, because what it really means is that we can only get rid of involuntary unemployment if we have a drop in real wages and an increase in demand, in effective demand, which is his major thesis. Now, with this, I'll come to read out a bit of this. This is where he defines the three types of unemployment. The first one is that fictional unemployment, which he defines a bit more elaborately than which I've held so far. For a realistic interpretation of it, legitimately allows for various inexactitudes of adjustment which stand in the way of continuous full employment. For example, unemployment due to a temporary want of balance between the relative qualities of the specialised resources as a result of miscalculation of intermittent demand, or to part-time lags consequent on unforeseen changes, or to the fact that the changeover from one employment to another cannot be effected without a certain delay, so that there will be always so there will always exist in a non-static society a proportion of resources unemployed between jobs. That's fictional unemployment. Generally speaking, it is more in most textbooks. It's defined exactly as I said earlier on in the talk, that if you just leave a job on Friday and you go to a fresh one on Monday, you'll be fictionally unemployed over the weekend. But then the second one, and this is where it's rather curious, in addition to fictional unemployment, the postulate also is compatible with voluntary unemployment due to the refusal or inability of a unit of labour as a result of legislation or social practices, or of a combination for collective bargaining, or a slow response to change, or of mere human obstinacy to accept the reward corresponding to the value of the product attributable to marginal productivity. But those two categories of fictional unemployment and voluntary unemployment are comprehensive according to the classics. Now, Keynes tends to think in terms of aggregates, but I think most people would think that if I couldn't get a job because of certain trade union activity or some of the things that he mentioned there, that most people would consider that to be involuntary unemployment, wouldn't they? I tend to think they would anyway. You know, if I can't get a job no matter what I do, they won't let me cut wages or anything like that, which is against the union rules and so on. He calls that voluntary unemployment, because he's thinking in terms of the instead of thinking in terms of the individual, he's thinking in terms of the aggregate of labour as a whole, you see. And he's saying that labour as a whole, it's labour themselves, the labour unions themselves, that's put up the wage rates. So therefore then, labour, considering labour as a whole, labour has voluntarily put themselves out of work. Now, I now come to his final thing of, now this won't make so much sense on its own. The definition of involuntary unemployment is as follows. Men are involuntarily unemployed if, in the extent of a small rise in the price of wage goods relatively to the money wages, both the aggregate supply of labour willing to work for the current money wage and the aggregate demand for it at that wage would be greater than the existing volume of employment. Now, basically, what it's not clear from that, but in the rest of the book, he qualifies this, and basically, he is saying, as I said earlier on, that even if people were willing to take a wage cut, this would do no good, because there would be no effective demand to back this up, and if anything, it probably wouldn't even achieve a reduction of real wages, because as they take the wage cut, the price in the goods might the goods in the shop might fall more rapidly, and thereby real wages will rise rather than a cut. Also, he says, in any case, demand will be decreased by the fact that they've decreased their money wages, and so the lack of effective demand will ensure that unemployment is prolonged. Now, he has the central idea is that inflation can actually create effective demand, and indeed in most textbooks today inflation and effective demand are almost synonymous, except that there is, in some books they say, well, this can be offset if there is this demand for money, and you won't get the result of a price rise in the shops. There are two competing theories for inflation. One goes by the price rise in the shops, which can be offset by greater productivity. For example, a lot of the measures they've taken over the last 10 years in the UK might have been inflationary if we didn't have cheap goods from China and India and so on. That actually constituted more production, so therefore you had more goods to match the increased money supply. So the effect of prices in shops might not have register so much. But according to Keynes, this is a effective demand. But there is a fault with this, and the fault is that extra money, unless it's leads directly to production, it will not boost demand. You can't boost demand just by money. It is, in fact, Say's law, which says that you can only really boost demand by supply, by actually producing extra goods. If there's extra goods, then there is extra demand in the economy. You can't do it just by pure money. So therefore, then, the big weakness in Keynes's major thesis is that you can have effective demand by inflation. The major fault with it is that inflation isn't very good at boosting demand. If anything, it tends to decay the demand of the unit of money, and it also tends to mess up economic calculation, and so you'll get a situation where the economy is less fit to use money to as a means to matching supply to demand in the first place. So with inflation you tend to, and of course it also, more clearly, erodes the capital base. Now, the capital base of society is the one thing that plugs up real wages. The reason why we have mass immigration from the poorer countries to the richer countries is because the immigrant knows that for almost any job he does, he'll get paid more in the richer country than in the poorer country. The reason why is because there's more of a capital base in the richer country than in the poorer country. And inflation, of course, runs down the capital base. Now, Keynes has got the idea. Keynes's main idea, which is is a bit paradoxical, and he takes, like Marx, he takes many long arguments and many paradoxes to try and argue this out. But I think he's exactly like Marx with his idea of matching the labour theory of value to the actual prices, which is Marx admits it's not a price theory anyway. But I think he wanted it to be a price theory. He only admitted it wasn't a price theory anyway, because he knew that it wasn't a price theory anyway, if you see what I mean. But he had a long argument saying that it was doing something or other. Keynes knows, in a sense, Keynes sees this equilibrium. He sees this equilibrium thing that she's making the anarchy, which both Marx and Keynes don't like about the market. But instead of taking this on, it's a bit like the Fabians taking Hannibal dead on, in a spiky battle. Instead of taking equilibrium theory dead on, he instead tries to waylay equilibrium theory by saying that you can have a full an equilibrium with mass unemployment and with idle resources. Now, this is a will strike most economists as being tremendously paradoxical. But he has all sorts of ideas to try and explain away this paradox. And he doesn't take equilibrium head on. He says, in fact, it can be waylaid by, because it is compatible. There is an equilibrium which is compatible with idle resources. What he does take on is what I mentioned earlier, the law I mentioned earlier, that supply tends to boost demand. And he takes it on by saying the classical economists said that supply creates its own demand. And as I say, he uses throughout he uses his solecism, as I might call it, throughout the book, when he says that the classical economists say this or the classical economists say that. He's not really talking about what the classical economist said. He's talking about, he's just making his major message. It doesn't really matter that classical economists don't say this. You can easily find the classical economists don't say anything like this, but that doesn't matter. It's his major message. And he says the classical economists say that, they don't say it, but it doesn't matter, that supply creates its own demand to such an extent that if we supply something, then there's no job of entrepreneurial job to be done to matching supply to demand, because you've already got your demand with the supply. We have a situation where he says that Say's law actually gets rid of the job of entrepreneurship, and it also gets rid of the job of mass unemployment. So what the classical economists are saying is basically that you have no mass unemployment, because they're saying that they go along with Say's law, which holds that there's no problem here. Any production will boost demand, and the market will automatically clear, and there'll be no problem whatsoever. Now, there was a story told about Adam Smith when I was at university from game theory, saying that Adam Smith says that society is a positive sum game, a situation where both sides can win. But we can find the prisoner's dilemma, where we've got a story where both sides don't win, someone has to lose out at the expense of another. So therefore then this refutes Adam Smith. But of course Adam Smith didn't say, and didn't even hint, that all social interaction was positive sum. Adam Smith knew full well about crime, and that crime was negative sum, and he knew about certain zero sum relations, like a game of tennis, for example, which would be zero, or football, which would be zero sum. You can either win, one team can win, or they can draw. So Adam Smith wasn't saying that the whole society was a positive sum or win-win situation. He was saying that trade is basically, and that there are but the game theorist people were using this prisoner's dilemma as a counterexample to Adam Smith, but they weren't using an example of trade. They were using an example of two prisoners about to serve sentences. This was a non-counterexample to Adam Smith. Well, likewise, Keynes has got a counterexample to general economics. He thinks that the economists don't know about involuntary unemployment, and in a special sense that he has defined involuntary unemployment, he might be right on that. But of course the classical economists knew about villages where it was difficult to get work no matter what the output was, and if you had a special trade you might have to go into the town. Now we know in the town, in a big city like Birmingham or London, there's less need to move about. There's good transport systems, and there is likely to be less likely to be any, in the normal sense of the word, involuntary unemployment. But in the villages, of course, you often get involuntary unemployment, depending on what you want to be employed as. there will very often be some involuntary unemployment in the normal sense, but not in the Keynesian sense. As I say, the Keynesian sense of involuntary unemployment is a lack of effective demand. Now, Keynes does actually think that he goes along with the trade union idea that wages can drop and drop and drop and drop to starvation levels if the government doesn't do something about it. Now, Keynes all along went along with the ages-old antagonism or prejudice, if you like, against the rate of interest. This was started off 2,500 years ago by Aristotle. Aristotle was very fond of biology, and he looked at money and he could see that money was obviously artificial, and he could see that money was increasing and growing, but it wasn't biological, so there must be something dodgy with it. So, in fact, Aristotle thought that there was something dodgy about the rate of interest, and actually ranted against it, that people were being tricked in some way or other. And throughout the years, 2,500 years, people have ranted against the rate of interest. Aristotle had an influence on Judaism, Christianity and Islam, and we know that Islam today is still very much against the rate of interest. You have the problem of Islamic banking and so on, and they're touchy about the rate of interest. And it was a case in Christianity as well, until Jeremy Bentham and one or two others at the turn of the from the 18th century to the 19th century wrote books in defence of usury and so on, and attacked the conventional wisdom against interest, and more or less provided in Britain and elsewhere a more favourable climate for the rate of interest. But Bentham didn't work with Keynes, as it were. He still has this prejudice against the rate of interest. He thinks that people are rewarded too much by the rate of interest, and he thinks that free trade in the rate of interest anyway, or a free market rate of interest, produces too much risk. He thinks that and he also thinks that savings is very, very bad. He thinks the whole job can be done by the state far better. If you just have general taxation as a form of saving, and you have a few bureaucrats to administer this, not only will this remove a lot of the risk from the market, presently the successful entrepreneurs have to be take a great deal of risk, and they're only lucky when they succeed, but it will remove a lot of the risk from the market. Also, we'll get the job done at a lower rate. People will be paid less. I mean, a lot of people think that the current National Health Service in Britain does a very good job for the public by paying the people who work for the National Health Service low wages, and that if you were to privatise them, we'd have to pay a lot more for our health, and they might have better wages in the health service, but the public generally wouldn't get such a good deal. Keynes has this sort of outlook as regards the rate of interest. If we just have saving by taxation and we have a few bureaucrats to set the rate of interest, he feels that you'll pay them far less and society will be better served as a result. Keynes definitely then wants, but he definitely wants a role for more planning, but he doesn't want society to be completely planned like Marx wanted. He thinks that that he has got the general theory of unemployment, interest and money, but the current economics, the classical economics, is all right for the particular condition of full employment, which he thinks is following Malthus. He thinks it's going to be rare and almost impossible, except when the state can come in and by inflating can produce effective demand which can clear up the mass unemployment. For once the mass unemployment has been cleared up, he then thinks the market comes into its own, and in that special situation of full employment, ordinary economics, classical economics, works quite well. Basically, he thinks then that he's explained why you get mass unemployment. You get it because the reason that equilibrium is capable of settling at a stage where there is idle resources, especially mass unemployment, and nothing will move it on to clear the market, because if they do try to price themselves into jobs, what they'll do is that they'll lower effective demand. He's got a device called the multiplier, actually, which he took from Keynes, which was an employment multiplier. But he says this is an investment multiplier, where he assumes idle resources, and with a cash injection, he can actually put these idle resources to work. But actually, his main use of this idea is really as a divider rather than a multiplier, because what he wants to say is that not that so much as, although he does say that as well, he says that if we have extra money, that will be effective demand, and that will get the multiplier underway by employing idle resources. But also he wants to say the reverse, and it's the reverse of this that is his more central theme, that if we try to price ourselves into jobs, you'll have a divider, as it were, the multiplier acting in reverse, where people effective demand will evaporate and wages will sink lower and lower, and he thinks there can be no limit to how low they can sink. He also thinks that on the plus side, that the multiplier, a small injection in the economy, will actually produce a great deal of extra wealth, and he actually says at one point that this might even go on to infinity. So he has to remedy this to some extent, and he remedies this by the idea that there are certain leakages. In other words, there are certain things where people save and they don't spend, or they hoard and they don't spend, and this constitutes a leakage. Now, I think the actual what would happen if you actually did hoard is that this would just mean that other people would be able to buy more with their goods. You know, in other words, you'd have a slight deflationary effect. So I don't think that this would upset the economy very much. So I think then that Keynes thinks that conventional economics is a special theory. He doesn't like it anyway. He doesn't like the anarchy of it. He doesn't like the equilibrium of it, and the fact that it doesn't need any state interference. He hates throughout. It became obvious as soon as I read the book many years ago that what he dislikes most of all is the attack on politics that it is in ordinary economics. But of course, the attack on politics, which is in ordinary economics, is taken very much as perfect competition and so on, is today by the average economist. In other words, it's just theory. It's not meant to be taken seriously. It doesn't really mean perfect competition and so on. That's just theory. And I think before the war and before 1936, people reading the attack on politics in the ordinary textbooks didn't think that economics was more important than politics or anything like that. But Keynes would really object, actually, to the LA's interpretation of this. Mm. He would really object to the LA. That they would be, the real communists. Are most prone to the economic calculation argument, so the LA are most prone to Keynes' sort of argument. His ideal solution then is to create a bureaucracy that will do all the saving, sort out the saving and investment, and then he thinks society will be all right. Now there is something, there are many ideas that I meant to cover that I haven't covered, but perhaps we can cover them in discussion.
Very good. Very good. Thank you, David. I have to say, someone with an ordinary graduate degree in economics, that would seem not really good. Someone who has read very widely in the subject hit all the spots. It covered the essentials. It was entirely right, I have to say.
I think it wished you well.
Very good. How are we doing for time? I used to just plough on with the recordings, but what with CDs lacking 18 minutes, what I do, it won't mean anything. Eventually I'll just stop them at 80, before 80 minutes and start them again and get two separate tracks. It's a matter of mere technicality. Right, on to the questions then?
Yes, yeah? Certainly.
Any questions?
I've got some. I'll be very welcome to hear them.
Is this about recording? Sorry.
Oh, we are recording the...
So that's kind of intimidating.
Oh, sorry.
Oh, sorry.
Oh, hang on.
No problem.
Don't have to tell you. You don't have to say your name.
Disguise your voice.
Chatham House. Was it? Was it Chatham House?
It can't be Chatham House.
Was it LA or something?
Oh, just no. Just
Libertarian Alliance.
Sorry?
This group is called the Libertarian Alliance, which is the LA.
Sorry. Okay.
Big pardon.
It's rather like not having a recording and not putting it on the web.
No, I understand.
It's a bit like that. For all the effect. Oh yes, lady at the back.
You mentioned that Keynes believed that there is no limits downwards at the wages.
The wages, yeah.
And yet, sounds like common sense that you reduce the wages at some point. Some people might be interested in buying the potential work. So, what logic really does he use to think that to say that there will be no limits?
Well, I think it is a bogus point that he's got. The trade unions have got it as well. It's a fear in the trade unions. And Keynes, liked many of these odd ideas that are going around in the unions, and also pushed by Major Douglas and some other monetary, they're commonly called monetary tranks, but monetary writers, you know, not in. And he took these seriously. But I don't think he had any explanation of why they continue to go down and down and down, except the one that I gave, that you need effective demand as well as a wage cut. And he thought that effective demand wasn't going to come automatically.
I think he thought, I may jump in, even as chairman, that the fact that most income goes to wage earners, 70%.
Yes.
And if they have less to spend, we have the downward spiral. Or is it a helix? Is there a mathematician in the house? Anyway, our spiral's flat. Two-dimensional. Anyway, the idea was that they have less to spend, therefore the demand falls, you know, and the rest writes itself, so down we down, down we go. Now, of course, if we're simply going down in nominal wages, merely pound wages, but the output is maintained, how can our income be less? The same stuff's being made, it's being distributed in the same proportions, we're chowing it down, we're basking in the light of it, we're rubbing it all over ourselves, we're listening to it, we're doing whatever. Wages haven't fallen at all, only nominal wages. Now, of course, for some workers, not all workers, some workers have to reduce their real wages, but not all workers have to reduce their wages, because it's not just all or nothing, it's not just one worker, but one wage rate, although aggregate thinking might incline you to that view. Some workers are overpaid, some workers are underpaid, possibly, but the market will sort it out, and the wage rate, in nominal terms, in money terms, is whatever it is, but the real wage comes from what you all turn out. If you're all turning out the same stuff, you're going to get the real wage. Overall, some may get a bit less of the real wage, some may get a bit more of a real wage, but it doesn't collapse.
Yes.
How would Keynes think this theory related to the political system and democratic policies? For Keynes to support, you need constant supervision and management by a political bureaucratic class. This is the idea.
Yes. Service.
Now, did he envisage that there would be sort of booms and busts and things going wrong?
No.
But do you think that there could just be a constant steady
booms and busts would be replaced by demand management?
By demand management,
yeah.
But surely isn't that, and my economics is not good, and I wish I'd learned more in the last 20 years when I knew everything was happening. But when the non-static that he's referring to, isn't that precisely the boom and bust scenarios? So the example you gave of going to the village, to the city, that's in a static conception of an economy. People move, but that's a static conception of an economy. Keynes is surely trying to deal with the notion of an economy that is non-static.
Yeah.
And a non-static economy has dynamisms and movements and forces that can potentially be, can potentially be disastrous.
Yeah.
And possibly boom and bust. So surely, in a non-static conception of economy, boom and bust is implicit within that.
Well, what Keynes doesn't like about boom and bust is this.
He doesn't like it. No one likes
it. No. He doesn't think it's true. Whether he thinks it's true, he says that it doesn't happen. And the reason why his theory is convinced that it doesn't happen is this. See, the classics, that's the other economists, tend to think that full employment is the norm. I think that's true. I think the classics do think that full employment is the norm. You use the classics meaning every economist apart from Keynes, I think nearly all of them, apart from Malthus actually, even Marx had the idea of a trade cycle. Keynes actually doesn't think there's a trade cycle. This is exactly what I'm trying to explain to you now, because Keynes thinks that the norm is what they would call the slump. See, what they think is that you have a boom where you have full employment, then you have a slump, and then you have a boom again. He thinks the norm is the slump.
And a permanent
slump. It'll be a permanent slump, and you won't get a boom. The boom will not come. Therefore, there's no trade cycle. Now, what you need is demand management. And with demand management, you can make the new norm, which is full employment, and then the classical stuff comes into its own. So basically, ironically, although it's to do with the slump and the mass unemployment, it is an alternative to the trade cycle.
Because he thinks, in that sense, boom and bust, yes, it's a bad thing.
No, I'm not on about whether it's a bad thing. Whether it's a bad thing or not.
He wants to get out of it.
He thinks it doesn't happen. There isn't any boom.
So he just lived through the 30s. He's seen the bust.
No. He admits that's really bad. But he thinks that even good times are a kind of gradual, low-key bust.
Perhaps an inheritance from Marx, in that sense.
No, Marx thought that there were booms and busts. And all the classical economists thought. In fact, actually, Keynes is... One of the things Keynes said about the classics under this solecism device or ploy is that the classical theories didn't understand about the trade cycle. So there was I was going to mention in my talk, this is part of the thing that I should add in. It's on the first, when I send this to the list, you'll see it's on the first page, but I missed it out. There was a book called The Worldly Philosophers, first written in 1954 by Heilbronner. And he went along with the Keynesian thing, and of course he said that Ricardo didn't talk about the trade cycle because none of them knew anything about the trade cycle. This was part of what Keynes said. He said the classics don't talk about it, they didn't know anything about it. Now what this man called Thomas Sowell, in a book I borrowed from Stephen in the 1970s, came out in 1972, Black Education, Myth and Tragedy, or Myth and Reality, said he got these classes, teaching this class of people. And he opened up a copy on each desk of Heilbronner's Worldly Philosophers and another of Ricardo's Principles of Taxation, where on the chapter where he talks about the booms and busts. And he got the whole class to read it. And then he says, "Now, what do you think of Heilbronner?" And the class to a man said, "Well, what he says about Ricardo is right." And they say, "Why do you say that?" He says, "Well, he wouldn't have said so otherwise." That's what we mean by mindset. Yeah, that's a bit like the reaction to the stagflation that we were talking about when Bob gave his talk. You know, you had this stagflation, which was the reaction of the refutation of Keynes. You had inflation and mass unemployment at the same time. You know, in other words, affecting demand and mass unemployment.
Depending on your economic viewpoint.
Well, no, you had that as a matter of fact in the 1970s.
But how you reduce it, I mean, Marx wouldn't reduce it in those terms, would he?
But Keynes
attempted. No, but we're talking about Keynes. Sure, he said that with effective demand, which is inflation, you wouldn't have mass unemployment. You had both of them at the same time in 1975. Now, they more or less didn't rewrite the textbooks. Keynes went on. Now, part of this is because, as I've been studying recently, part of this is because they thought that only a part of Keynes was refuted, namely the Phillips curve, and they did throw that out. But that only emerged in 1957, the Phillips curve. So and that's why after Keynes. So they're only throwing out a component of neo-Keynesianism, if you like.
But you're presuming, sorry, in this, I mean, this is first year, I mean, I remember these things, Sayes and Phillips Gerst, this is the first year economics.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
And you're presuming the science, the dismal science of economics, as the ground by which you judge all these theories. I mean, if you're referring to these as the ground by which you analyse economics, and all of these people, Keynes and Marx, would themselves criticise the very ontology of that economic theory that you're using to describe and explain.
Yeah.
And it is a very limited ontology, isn't it? It's an ontology of equilibrium, of stasis,
I don't think this dynamic thing works very well. No one uses it, including Keynes and Marx. Marx was an Aristotelian. In other words, he aimed for the static analysis, the static logic of Aristotle. However,
it's very hard not to be static. It
did
take a lot of time.
Well, Hegel thought he was dynamic with his dialectics. And Marx played around with dialectics, but in actual fact, he basically followed Aristotle in his static logic, and most people do. What I was going to say is this. What you're saying is that what I'm doing is basically begging the question.
I've never quite understood that phrase. Let me
bore everyone here by telling you exactly what it means. It bores people because I'm going to bring in something that certainly bores Bob and a lot of other people. I'm going to bring in justification, you see. Begging the question is that you assume without justification.
What you're saying.
Well, I actually think there is no such thing as justification. That's where I bore people. And so therefore, there's nothing but we can do nothing but beg the question, in my opinion. In other words, all analysis is free of justification.
So it's relativist, you're a relativist.
No, I'm an absolutist, but I'm a skeptic.
That's another talk. More of a paparium. Let's cover the whole room. Question here.
David, thank you very much. That was very enlightening. And by the way, I think Marx would have said that beware of, at his time, it was a period of movement that was going to go into bust because of the iron law of salaries and so on. So it was a long, long decline from boom to, you know, bust and depression and so on. But you mentioned something about interest rates and Keynes' views on interest rates.
Yes.
And you mentioned that it was influenced by Major Douglas and all the social credit, you know, group and Weaven and all these people. Could you elaborate a bit on this? Because there is a fallacy there, which is very irritating. I mean, these people from the social credit movement say, okay, there is a quantity of money, and as we are charged interest, where does the extra money to pay the interest comes from? You see, if we are in this room, and you make a loan to everybody in the room, so you have made a loan of all your assets, you know, all your money, and so on, then in order to pay you the interest, we have to find money elsewhere. But where does that money come from? Unless you create it, but then it comes out of thin air. So if you have a fixed quantity of money like gold, unless there is more gold that is being produced, which would then depend on, you know, finding more gold mines and so on, you come to this impossibility that the interest cannot be repaid. And it is a clever ploy, but I'm sure you have
I think, of course, there's nothing wrong with the rate of interest, and it's just renting money. You're basically renting money. I think that's perfectly all right. But Keynes himself hated it, and he wanted to get rid of the rate of interest completely. And he, as I said in the talk, he would get rid of it by instead of, and he also hated savers and saving. Mm. He'd get rid of savings and saving and the rate of interest a whole lot by sheer taxation. and taxation from direct from taxation to investment.
The Obama model, then.
Obama model.
It may be called. Well, a mixture of borrowing, taxation, and printing the bloody stuff.
Yeah.
We're now in America and in this country, a great deal of investment is proceeding via those means.
Yes.
Not from the public's monetary savings, but from.
Yes. The banks in the last 20 years haven't been doing these savings. They've been doing it.
One here.
Sorry, because I haven't had an
answer to
my question.
No. I think the answer is it comes from future production.
Future
money.
Unless you produce more.
You're talking about where the. Well, yes, you're going to produce.
Well, money's worth what you produce.
Money's only worth something if you're a future good.
I accept that, but I'm talking how. I mean, I'm not repaying the interest with future production. I'm repaying the interest with money.
Yes.
Now, if you have a fixed quantity of money that is being lent out, where does the money come to repay the interest?
Well. If there's going to be no further money, you're not expanding the money supply, then that money should buy more goods in future.
Yes.
With increased production.
Yeah, but where does the money come from?
I've got an answer if you want.
Yeah.
Well, the successful ones pay repay out of profits. The unsuccessful ones pay out of their assets, if they have any. And if they haven't got any assets, they don't repay it at all.
I accept that. But would the lender agree to be paid in automobiles or tires or tables or food?
These things are sold either profitably or
but if they are sold,
in distress
they are sold
mode.
For money.
Yeah, to other people.
Yes.
Yeah, but then if there is a fixed quantity of money,
yeah,
which a lot of economists argue that there should be.
Well, not enough, I have to say.
Well, that's
yeah,
my point.
But the hospitals do.
But there are people outside the circle of the lender and the borrower, are there other people who
well,
the
that is only moving the thing, you know, before. It's a regression at infinitum.
Yeah, well, Christian's point is that the rate of interest implies an increase in the denomination of money, which can't happen if you have a fixed, if
you
have a gold supply.
I don't think so.
No,
he's a speaker. Give me
I mean, I don't think that there is. Are you saying that extra money is needed to pay back for the rent of interest?
That's exactly what I mean.
No, but what I said earlier on, you go over exactly what I said earlier on, which is perhaps a bit boring, and perhaps I shouldn't. But what I said earlier on is the rate of interest is just the rent for money. Now, I don't need extra money to pay rent for my room from week to week, you know, and rent on interest is just like rent, just like that.
No,
all you're doing is paying rent. You don't need extra money to pay rent.
No, you do need extra money.
You do?
No,
I am. Oh.
What is the point, though?
The point is, if there is a fixed quantity of money,
yes,
and it is all the lenders lend it to the borrowers,
yes,
the rate of interest,
yes,
then it can't repay more than that amount of money that's been lent.
If it's a fixed quantity,
because you increase the rate of circulation, yes.
Well, yeah, but there isn't only one. Also, prices
is dynamism.
Also, if you bring in dynamism, with a fixed money stock, prices will fall. So,
yeah.
So if you repay even only a pound for a pound, because you can have negative interest rates, a pound for a pound, the pound in a year's time will buy you more.
Yes, but it's
so you're still earning an interest rate.
But it's lent at a nominal interest rate.
Yeah, but it needn't be.
No, it needn't be. And presumably in a properly functioning economy with a fixed money supply, such as gold, you wouldn't have banks lending out money with interest. You would have actual investors investing in enterprises,
yes,
wouldn't you? Which,
finance
which is the way around here. You would
keep
it. Yeah, because what the banks are doing in the fractional reserve system with the fiat currency is not investing. It's, yeah, this is rent. It's not like lending money to a friend. Maybe this is
some of it.
This is it's not. Yeah.
I'm still missing the point. I can't see why we can all see
how we get richer with the fixed quantity of money and how production can go up, but what you can't have is if the interest is
the lending rate from banks was only 1%. They gave the customers 1%, and if people borrowed money it was about 1.25% to 1.5%, and all this thing the banks got greedier and greedier. And the whole thing went
topsy-turvy. I think
14 to 16. any other service than lending money? Is a service like any other service?
Yes.
Yes. That was my point.
If people pay for a service, whatever it is,
that's right.
Why don't they have money to pay for the interest rate? It comes out of non-consuming for a thing.
I think you're quite right. I am missing the point. I can't see why you need extra money to pay interest.
Exactly. It's like
but Christian's making a point.
I think we're all missing a point here.
I am missing the point.
The total number of goods at a price add up to more than the money there is. We're missing the fact that there's money's worth. And there's the money to pay. If that thing were bought immediately, in one second, there wouldn't be enough money to pay for everything there is at the price it's at. It doesn't work like that.
Exactly. Because the amount of products varies all the time. Products are created and products are destroyed all the time. So there's no fixed amount of money for a fixed amount of product.
Money isn't consumed as is exchanged, is it? Money isn't consumed as is exchanged.
The only thing you can say is that the banker, I mean bankers, are human beings, and they eat and they consume and so on, and therefore
rather more than me, or not.
Therefore, they recycle the money they earn, the interest they earn goes back into the economy. But nonetheless, at the end of the day, if interest rates are 4%, you need 4% more of money stock.
I didn't know that.
But of course you do.
You do.
But of course you
know.
I mean, you do.
Well, I can see exactly your point. It's a no-brainer.
Paul believes in Islamic finance.
So you say zero, it'd be zero interest.
No.
But in a system where you have a fixed quantity of money, such as a gold fund, when there's no newly mined gold, I mean, you have a gold fund, you have your fixed quantity of money. You all get richer because the gold there is becomes more valuable. But now it's gold, it's also an asset.
You're chairman, but we haven't got any.
At the end of the day, if you say we'll lend you 2 ounces of gold and you've got to pay me back 3, then where does this extra gold come from? If gold is the money and the interest is a fixed quantity of gold, you can't do it.
The gold becomes more valuable, but in a properly functioning market economy with a fixed supply of money, we don't have.
Interest is intimately linked to inflation. You would have deflation with the money. Yeah, exactly.
Because the price is full.
Yes, but the point
zero.
Is the interest is denominated
wait
in,
a minute.
In the gold.
Wait a minute. A price of an interest rate of 0%, pardon me, Mr. Speaker, an interest rate of 0% would be a positive interest rate.
Yes.
If prices were falling.
Yeah, well, that's an answer.
And if we have growth with, well, actually, not even growth, if we have 0%.
Yeah,
interest rates.
Or you could say I would lend you the money. Yeah, I'll lend you the 2 ounces of gold. And you can lend me 1.5. You pay me 1.5 back with the expectation that you'll buy more in the future.
So
that's
even zero.
That's an answer.
But even less than zero.
Yeah.
It's a bit funny to think about.
If prices
are falling that fast,
but,
a negative interest rate would still be a positive one.
Yeah.
If it were above the falling price, because
well,
you get more purchasing power back in a year's time.
Yeah,
let's
say. Well, that answers the point. Yeah.
I think it does.
Yeah.
Okay.
Move on. Next question.
we won because, in other words, what we said is that there wouldn't be interest rates.
What about the
interest rate? So
there'd be no interest rates for corporate clients, no?
What about the paradox of saving?
His demonstration, which I accept.
Paradox
of saving is if we are in a deflationary environment, then we would have zero interest rates. In other words, the quantity of money would remain.
Can I help myself with some of this?
Yes, of course.
No, then you couldn't, because then you would have to lose more money.
Yeah, but Gilbert went further and he disapproved of schemes around it. Yeah, he was an ambassador. He was
Let's tempt a bit of order through the chair. Has anybody got a point they want to raise to David? What I want to ask David is a lot of what the government in this country and around the world are doing is being described as Keynesian. this pump priming, this fiscal stimulus is Keynesian. Is how far is it actually related to anything Keynes said?
Well, it seems to be completely Keynesian.
Yeah.
Because Keynes held that producing more money would create effective demand almost by definition. And therefore, then, this would clear up mass unemployment. So that seems to be completely Keynesian.
But didn't Keynes also have a monetary policy, which was the notion of controlling exchange between nations?
Yeah.
And the whole Bretton Woods argument is something that is completely missing, as in the last 30 years has been completely demolished since America, whenever it was in 1970.
Yeah, around about 1971, yeah.
Blah, 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 blah.
Yep.
And in that sense, you know, it's only half the Keynesian story you're saying is Keynesian. The other half is the control of capital flow.
Well, for what you've got to find.
And Keynes was in favour of control of capital flow. And in that sense, they're precisely not Keynesian. Many Keynesians would say that this the failure of the response to this crisis is that it's not Keynesian in its control of capital flow. And I speak not as an economist, just
yeah.
as a partial and inadequate understanding.
But he would still think that creating money, what I said earlier on, creating money would be effective demand.
But not indiscriminately.
No, he would. Well, for once you get full employment, you then need an incomes policy to stop inflation. Because, I mean, according to Keynes.
These are the 70s arguments against Keynes, but I mean, Keynes also had this notion, I mean, which also Thatcher destroyed, didn't she? And Reagan, the notion of controlling the but the exchange rates, the whole notion of capital flows between nations and protection of nations from.
Yeah, he's very much nationalist. He wanted the whole of capital to. I mean, part of what Keynes did. I mean, I was going to say I had a section on the revolution in the talk, which I left out completely, owing to I don't know. I got to I just overlooked it. But basically, I was going to have a look at the Keynesian Revolution, which I put in inverted commas. And what I was going to say is I was going to point out, which I think I pointed out in earlier talks actually, that the pristine use of revolution was introduced in 1688 into politics. And basically, it was introduced by the Whigs after James II had come as what they said half a revolution. And it was completing the revolution, going back to the status quo ante. Meant exactly, and ironically, given the romantic use of revolution, which is part of common sense now, and which emerged with the French Revolution, it meant exactly the same as reactionary. It meant going back to the status quo ante. Now, in 1789 in France, you had a new version of the word revolution, which really means more like going off on a tangent, because it means going, instead of going round and completing the revolution, it's going off. Off, as it were, into a new domain, and off on a tangent, and so the current use of the word revolution is to go on to a new epoch, if you like. So, and this is where Marx bases this romantic version of revolution.
So
you go from one epoch to another. You know, in other words, an onward flow instead of going round and round. So you go onward, and sorry,
I just revolution in Latin. What is Vol, is it fold or is it?
I'm afraid I don't know enough Latin, but I know that it comes. I mean,
anyway,
it was taken from mathematics, anyway, not Latin.
Greek,
but
is it Greek or Latin?
No, it's like Shakespeare, he knows little Latin and less Greek.
Yeah.
I know no Latin and even less Greek. Let's change tack here. I shall usurp the employ the prerogatives of the chair, or privileges, and say let's try a different angle, which is a kind of sociology of politics, a kind of political economy. What was it that Keynes was offering up that the politicians loved, grasped onto? Not in this country so much. This country got out of the Depression quicker than America and did the wrong things. Amongst other things, it cut civil service wages by 10%. It cut income tax by 10%. It cut the dole by 10%. Sadly, it raised tariffs 10%, but still, it was measurable. Everything else. And this country was far sharper out of the recession than the wonderful United States with the great FDR.
Which got out in 1946, according to some.
Quite right. So, what was it about Keynes's message that the politicians love so much.
Well, it was the politics, of course, is very important, and economics is not important.
Yes.
That politics should dominate economics. This is what Hitler said, actually. He says what we need, the chief thing we need to do is to make sure that politics reigns over economics. And the chief thing we need to oppose is liberalism. That's what he said. And Keynes didn't like the way that economics attacked politics, and he took it far more seriously than what he needed to do. Because, as I said, as I said earlier on, the average reader of an economics textbook didn't look at it as the LA do. See, but he would, as I said earlier on, absolutely hate the way the LA see economics as anti-politics. That's what Keynes feared was implicit in what the classics were saying, and it's what he didn't like. He didn't like it at all. But I think I was looking at his legacy. I was going to look in the talk. One of the ideas that I missed out in the talk, on his legacy. And it seems to me that he's... See, what happened, as I mentioned in the talk, or should have mentioned in the talk, what happened is that Keynes had a number of fans, some ideas, from Kahn was one of them,